This is The Best of Our Knowledge, a presentation of National Productions.
Last week, you may recall, we told you how more and more women are studying STEM, science, technology, engineering, and math. Right now, let's focus on the S, specifically the science of astronomy, where women have been instrumental since the 19th century.
They were given a remarkable opportunity to do astronomy when so many women didn't even work outside the home.
Today on The Best of Our Knowledge, we'll hear about the remarkable scientists who help us understand our place among the stars. We'll also look at some of the problems first-generation students have adjusting to college life. Follow two women as they trace Darwin's trip to the Galapagos Islands and spend an academic minute with tattooed ladies. I'm Bob Barrett, and this is The Best of Our Knowledge. In the mid-19th century, the field of astronomy was rapidly advancing. Thanks to developments in photography, astronomers were starting to make major discoveries about the stars. They began to understand the chemical composition of the heavens and to measure distance in space. They developed stellar classification systems that are still in use today. And at a time in the United States when women did not yet have the right to vote, many of these scientists were women, and Harvard University was hiring them to study the stars. Science writer Dava Sobel has explored the work of these women in her book, The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. She talked about the book and these remarkable women with the best of our knowledge's Jessica Blaustein Marshall.
They were ahead of their time. They were given a remarkable opportunity starting in the late 1800s to do astronomy, when so many women didn't even work outside the home. And they carried out that charge, that challenge, so well that they became nationally and internationally famous in their own lifetimes.
Now tell me about how this all got started.
The director's name was Edward Pickering, and the myth goes that one day he was set up with the sloppy work of one of his assistants and dressed him down by saying, "My maid could do a better job." And then he brought in his maid and she did a better job. But when I did my research, I read all the observatory correspondence. But it is true that he moved his domestic servant into the observatory and taught her how to do calculation work, what was then called computing, when computer was a job description instead of a machine. And he also taught her how to look at photographs of the night sky and make discoveries from them. So my book title, The Glass Universe, refers to a collection of glass photographs that Pickering started in the 1870s and that became a collection of 500,000 images, which are all still at Harvard. And this woman, the maid who became an astronomer, her name was Wilhelmina Fleming. She was a Scottish immigrant and had come to this country as a young bride. But then her husband vanished and she was pregnant. So she was in a desperate situation and took a job as a domestic servant at the observatory. But Pickering was very quick to recognize her intelligence. And when he arrived there, he found six women already employed there. So Pickering wasn't really the one who instigated the women's work at the observatory. That happened from his predecessors who, since they were living on site, would train their wives, their daughters, to do the work. And the wives and daughters proved themselves perfectly capable of the work. So then it was a little Harvard Observatory tradition. Pickering loved it because not only was the work getting done well, but women cost a lot less than men. For the price of one man, he could have two or even three women.
What was the work exactly? What did it involve?
Well, there were several projects going on. One challenge was to determine the brightness of all the stars. What is the reason for the differences in brightness? Another was to try to figure out different types of stars, other differences among them. Were stars showing a different stage in a life cycle, a different temperature, a different chemical makeup? At the start of this story, nobody knew what the stars were made of or how they functioned, why they produced heat and light.
This was major stuff. This wasn't...
Major stuff. So the women were, they were at the red hot center. They created the first widely accepted classification system for the stars, a system that's still in use today.
Wow.
They discovered a way to measure distances in space, figured out the relative abundance of different chemicals in the stars.
Tell me about some of the specific women and some of the contributions they made to the field.
Wilhelmina Fleming. Vickery moved her into the observatory, but then he helped her go home to Scotland to have her baby and promised her work if she would come back, which she did. She came back about 2 years later and worked at the observatory the rest of her life and published the first of the classification systems. She classified 10,000 stars. Another famous one was Annie Jump Cannon. She revised the classification system so that it was accepted by astronomers all over the world and is still in use. She was a foreign member of the Royal Astronomical Society. I mean, these were major, major recognitions. This was in the early 1900s.
I think it bears mentioning that at this same exact time, women didn't even have the right to vote yet.
Didn't have the vote, right.
Dr. Cecilia Helena Payne was another woman that you studied?
She came later. She didn't arrive at the observatory till the early 1920s. She came from England, where, although she'd been a brilliant student, she was told there was no future for her as an astronomer in that country. So she knew about the situation at Harvard, and she was able to get a fellowship. By the time she came, the number of women working at Harvard had attracted the attention of wealthy women who wanted to support the work. And so there were special fellowship opportunities where a woman could come and work at Harvard and be funded for that, and then be able to go get a job at another observatory. Miss Payne came over on one of these special fellowships for women, which were called Pickering Fellowships for Women. And she was one of the very first graduate students. The history of the women in the observatory also created this strange situation that when a graduate astronomy program was first set up, the only fellowship money available were these Pickering Fellowships. So all of the first graduate students in astronomy at Harvard were women. And Miss Payne was the first one to earn a PhD. And she did it by studying the glass plates. She was the one who discovered that the stars consist mostly of hydrogen and helium.
That's a major discovery.
Major discovery.
What challenges did these women face in doing this work, you know, within their field? Were people ignoring what they said, or were they...
That's what I find so exciting about the story. I mean, not only was the work interesting and challenging, and not only was it unusual that women were doing it and other women were providing funding for these projects. One woman provided $50,000, this was in 1890, to build a giant telescope in the southern hemisphere.
Wow.
So that the photography project could include all the stars, not just the ones that we can see from the northern hemisphere. So there was tremendous interest and involvement by women at many levels, and they were recognized by their peers in astronomy.
Again, the name of science writer Davis Sobel's book is The Glass Universe, How the Ladies of the Harvard Observatory Took the Measure of the Stars. She spoke with the best of our knowledge's Jessica Blaustein Marshall. And this segment first appeared on the National Productions program 51%. And you really, really should be listening to them. When we hear someone is the first person in their family to go to college, we usually congratulate them and look forward to their success. But these first-generation students sometimes have trouble adjusting to college life. Sophie Cannon reports.
In a recent study conducted by the Pell Institute, it was discovered that first-generation students are at higher risk of isolation when it comes to academic and social experiences. The same study reveals these students have lower graduation rates and GPAs due to transitional problems. Melissa Ferris, graduating senior and first-generation student, explains.
Most students have issues transitioning just because it's different from high school to college, but a lot of first-generation students don't have the background in, like, English and math, so they really struggle in those areas because they are typically low-income families, and they're not able to attend, like, higher high schools, so they're not as strong in those areas, so they struggle with that.
Though there are many factors that contribute to the overall performance of a college student, Ferris, through her research, has pointed out three large factors that hinder a first-generation student's college experience.
So the main ones we found were the academic, social, and financial, and where it really stems from and why they have these issues is the fact that their parents can't really help them. A lot of the students in the focus group said that they'll have friends who, like, have issues with class or social issues or anything like that, and they'll call their parents. But first-generation students are really more on their own.
Navigating the world of financial aid and private loans is not an easy task. According to Ferris, this is a problem that many first-generation students face.
Statistically, using FAFSA, first-generation students have to pay about $36,000 out of pocket to go to college each year. But when you look at the loans as well, it's about $6,000 total, including the loans. But typically their families have an average year income of $12,000. So that's half of their family's income. So it's not reasonable for them to be able to, their families to be able to help them. So they're really doing it on their own. And in addition to going to class, they're working about 20-ish hours a week just to be able to pay for school.
Ferris, a psychology major from Marlboro, Mass., personally connects to this issue and has worked throughout her senior year to research and help develop a program specifically catering to this underserved population through her independent study. Looking back at her 4 years of college, Ferris describes how being a first-generation student has affected her.
I didn't have anyone to, like, tell me what college was like or to help me with the whole process. Like, luckily I have, like, friends, families who helped me with, like, the applications and figuring it out. My guidance counselor was really helpful in high school, but I had to fill the FAFSA out by myself. I had no idea what I was signing. I still really don't know what I owe, and I just have no idea. So the FAFSA itself was really confusing. And then coming to college and not, like, really knowing what to do or what resources I should be using and things like that.
Being a first-generation student comes with its challenges, but Ferris points out how this struggle has helped her and gives advice to first-generation students about to enter college.
And I think it also kind of helped me, though, because I, like, wanted to, like, prove people wrong that, like, I could do it. Be that person that's always calling over the summer to ask questions. Like, if you don't know the answer to something, don't just wait. Call and figure it out. And also make sure you're going to those people. Know if there's a first-year office type place to help first-year students at your college. If you have a peer advisor, text them. That's what they're there for. Take advantage of getting tutors in the Writing Center and Math Center. So really just take advantage of anything that if you're struggling in an area, there's someone out there that can help you with it. So just trying to figure out that place and using it.
Reporting from Western New England University, I'm Sophie Cannon.
Still to come, we head down to the Galapagos Islands, where two women are following in Darwin's footsteps. That's next on The Best of Our Knowledge. Got any questions or comments about The Best of Our Knowledge? Send them in. Our email address is knowledge@wamc.org. And if you'd like to listen to this or any past programs again, you can find them online at our flagship station's website. Just go to wamc.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to The Best of Our Knowledge's podcast or download the WAMC radio app to listen on demand anytime, anyplace. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Charles Darwin revolutionized science. His theory of evolution was based on careful observations of birds and other wildlife in places like the Galapagos Islands. One thing that has been evolving, albeit a little bit slowly, is the gender mix in science, where men still dominate many of the fields like they did in Darwin's day more than 150 years ago. But women are breaking in and making a difference. We're going to meet up with two young women scientists in, where else, the Galapagos Islands. Veronique LaCapra is our guide.
I'm Veronique, and this is Mari.
Mi nombre es Maricruz Jaramillo,
Y soy de Quito, Ecuador.
Mari Cruz Jaramillo grew up in Ecuador's capital, Quito, but she always loved being out in nature.
When I look at pictures of myself when I was little, I always see, like, I have a really happy face when I'm outside. I don't know, maybe I associated it with spending time with my family and my dad. Then I could just run and I would pick up stuff from the ground. And I just really love being outdoors.
I was pretty much the same way. I brought my mom home tadpoles, caterpillars, earthworms, and eventually a PhD in ecology and evolution. Mari's getting hers now from the University of Missouri, St. Louis. And she's doing fieldwork in the one place I think every ecologist wants to go.
Ever since I knew I wanted to be a biologist, I wanted to come to the Galapagos Islands. That was my goal and my dream, too.
But they're not easy to get to. The Galapagos Islands are in the Pacific, 600 miles west of Ecuador. From St. Louis, it took me 2 days, 3 flights, a ferry ride, and 45 minutes in a pickup truck to get there. Charles Darwin took a ship, the HMS Beagle. He was only 26 when he visited the Galapagos, about Mari's age. What he saw changed his life and the history of science. Most of the wildlife that lives on these volcanic mounds is found nowhere else in the world. Giant tortoises, marine iguanas, and those little sparrow-like birds known as Darwin's finches. Mari first made it to the Galapagos 5 years ago. She's back again, studying a kind of malaria that's infecting birds here. In Hawaii, avian malaria has driven many native bird species to extinction. That hasn't happened in the Galapagos, but Mari and other scientists are trying to gauge the threat.
It's 5:30 in the morning, and it's just barely starting to get light in the sky. I'm meeting the researchers who are going to be setting up some mist nets to catch birds.
Who wants to set another net?
Mist nets look sort of like volleyball nets, but around twice as high and reaching almost to the ground. Their mesh is nearly invisible. The birds fly right into it and get snagged. Mari and the others work quickly to untangle them.
When you have a bird in your hand, it's just really warm and soft, and you can feel its really fast heartbeat. And you just know that you're holding something really fragile.
Each bird gets weighed and measured.
This one's 45 grams.
Mari, or one of her helpers, takes a small blood sample to test later for malaria. Then they release the bird again.
This little one is ready to go.
Laulatagu na Samoa Asigao, buna launa Papua New Guinea kekenina.
Samoa Asigao speaks Motu, along with Pidgin and English, among the many languages in her country, Papua New Guinea. It's an island nation just north of Australia. Samoa met Mari in graduate school in St. Louis. She's in the Galapagos trying to help solve a different piece of the avian malaria puzzle. Which species of mosquito is transmitting the parasite from bird to bird? Just before dusk, Samoa sets out her traps.
The thing about trapping mosquitoes is you have to think like a mosquito.
Female mosquitoes, they're the ones that bite and can spread disease, like to lay their eggs in stagnant water. So Samoa mixes up a smelly brew for her traps.
Every time I pour this water, in my mind I'm like thinking like, mosquitoes, please come, come to it. So I can trap more mosquitoes in the morning. Seriously, that's what I do every time. Oh, it smells good, right?
Actually, it smells like rancid gym socks. The smellier the water, the more mosquitoes she'll get and be able to dissect. Working with a microscope, delicate tools, and very steady hands, she'll chop off their tiny heads and extract their salivary glands to look for the malaria parasite. Samoa has stared at so many mosquitoes so close up, she has started to appreciate them, especially a species called Aedes aegypti.
It's one of the most beautiful things I've ever seen. It's covered in these black and white bands all over its legs, all over its abdomen, its face, and yeah, the first time I saw it under a microscope, I kind of fell in love with it in a weird way.
Samoa says her parents encouraged her to get an education and pursue a career in science. But she says most people in Papua New Guinea hold strongly to traditional beliefs.
and gender roles.
And just growing up and looking around and seeing the opportunities that were given to males rather than females, that sort of placed an aggression in me, good aggression, that told me that, hey, why do males always have to get chosen over females?
For Samoa, becoming a scientist started out as a way to prove herself. But eventually, it became more than that.
I realized that, no, science was something that I really wanted to do.
Once she gets her PhD, Samoa wants to return to Papua New Guinea to help protect wildlife there. And she hopes to be a role model and train a new generation of female scientists.
Empower young girls, empower women, and tell them, you know, if I can come from a country like Papua New Guinea, come and do research in a place like Galapagos and study at an institution like my university, then you can do it too.
Her friend Mari plans to keep doing research in her home country of Ecuador, maybe in the Galapagos Islands.
I don't know exactly if I would enjoy my life as much if I wasn't a scientist.
Sometimes, though, Mari thinks about all the hard work and long hours.
But then I realized, like, what else would I be doing? I wouldn't be enjoying it as much if I was doing something else. So it's my way of life. It's essentially what I am, I think.
I'm Veronique Capra.
This story was produced for the PRX STEM Story Project with support from the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation. You might be surprised that it took this long, but women are now getting way more tattoos than men. And that's the topic of today's Academic Minute.
Women now get more tattoos than men in the U.S. I'm Dr. Lynn Pascarella, president of the Association of American Colleges and Universities. And today on the Academic Minute, Beverly Thompson, associate professor of sociology at Siena College, explores how discrimination still follows women in this artistic endeavor.
Record numbers of Americans are getting tattoos. At least 25% of the population now has at least one. And for the first time ever, women make up over 50% of all collectors. My research focuses on this often overlooked population. Heavily tattooed women, who have large tattoos on public skin and imagery not considered pretty, such as skulls or snakes, often face social sanctions. Women manage their tattoos to a greater extent than men, as being heavily tattooed goes against stereotypical expectations of what it means to be feminine. But the women themselves view their tattoos as something that makes them more beautiful and authentic. Women tattoo artists face discrimination from both employers and potential clients, similar to women in other male-dominated professions. From male tattoo artists who refuse to take on women apprentices, to sexual harassment and derogatory treatment in the workplace, women tattoo artists have had their own Me Too movement in their industry. Women artists may face clients who overlook them as receptionists, do not want tattoos done by a woman, or think that women have a lighter touch with the tattoo machine. With the sheer number of people in contemporary society, this research provides insight into understanding the idea of tattoo etiquette or how the public can most respectfully interact with people regarding their tattoo collections. By reconsidering the reasons for questioning another's body adornments, not touching, and understanding that tattoos are simply one manner of self-expression, observers can work towards lessening the social stigma surrounding women's tattoo collections.
And that was Beverly Thompson of Siena College. You can find this, other segments, and more information about the professors at academicminute.org.
The Academic Minute is a production of WAMC, Northeast Public Radio, in partnership with the Association of American Colleges and Universities. That's all the time we have for this week's program. If you'd like to listen again, join us online at our flagship station's website. Go to WAMC.org and click on the programs link. And while you're there, subscribe to our podcast or any of the other WAMC or National Productions podcasts. And if you have any questions or comments about the program, send them in. Our email address is knowledge@WAMC.org, and you can find us on Twitter at @TBOOKnowledge. I'm Bob Barrett. Be sure to join us next time for another edition of The Best of Our Knowledge.
Bob Barrett is producer of The Best of Our Knowledge. Dr. Alan Chartok is executive producer. The Best of Our Knowledge is a production of WAMC Radio's National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Hear more at wamc.org.